Hello, this is Dana Taylor. Welcome to my audio version of Shiny Green Shoes. This year, you can find the story in an anthology I've entitled Hope for the Holidays. Two new stories are included in the book, Patty's Angels and Refiner's Fire. You can find me on the web at definitelydana.wordpress.com and supernalfriends.com. Well, I hope you'll sit back and relax and enjoy this story of a little girl who discovers that dreams do come true. Shiny Green Shoes by Dana Taylor. Prologue, 1958, New Orleans. High heels echo across the deserted stage floor. Set pieces surround me, ghostly illusions of imagination waiting for lights and music to call them to life. I like the quiet time, before all the noise and energy and magic swirls in the air like the trail of stars from Tinkerbell's wand. Now, in the sanctuary of my dressing room, I lock the door and recline on the wide sofa, wide enough for my generous hips and impressive bosom. Surrounded by musty theater smells, dangling costumes of feathers and satin, I gather myself, find myself, remember myself. An actress can get lost in her characters, confused by playwright's emotions and bedazzled by her fans. Being Maisie McDonald, big, black, and boldly beautiful, isn't easy. I lean back on the comfy cushions and conjure the other Maisie, the hidden Maisie that only a few can see. A scrawny, gangly child, uncertain of her place in the world, overlooked in the struggle to keep mind and body together. In the quiet, that Maisie comes to me. My gaze travels across the room to the row of shoes, each one placed under a matching costume, a final accessory to set off the gown and flash under a shapely long leg. The younger Maisie is agog with wonder and delight. So many pretty shoes, dazzling rainbow colors made just for a Maisie foot. Lord, Lord, what miracles you have wrought on this wide-eyed child of the South. Chapter 1. Luther, Oklahoma, 1935. My fascination with shoes began with a bright green shiny pair winking at me from the store window Mama and I passed every day on the way to the night house in the white part of town. Until that day in my eighth year in 1935, I had no idea such wonders existed. The ugly stiff-leathered hand-me-downs that came my way pinched my toes and made me awkward. I shuck them ratty old things the first sign of spring, running free until winter frost forced my feet into confinement once again. We lived in Luther, Oklahoma, which survived the woes of the Depression and Dust Bowl by clinging to the lifeline of Route 66. My family survived by our work ethic, strong backs, and a faith in the Almighty. As the youngest child in a family of six, I'd learned to lurk and stay out of everybody's busy way. With a quiet demeanor, believe it if you will, and a vivid imagination, I trailed behind Mama in a daydreamy world far richer than our hardscrabble reality. So when I saw those bright green shoes, my imagination danced and twirled as I stood mesmerized by their glowing beauty. "Maisie June," Mama said, "quit your dawdling. We got a mess of work to do." "Mama," I said, "I'm going to have me a pair of shoes like that some day." Mama glanced at the treasures in the window and pursed her lips. "Well, who do you think you are? Shirley Temple? People like us wear plain work shoes. Times is hard, and the sooner you realize that you got to earn your keep in this world, the better. I don't know where you get all your fancy ideas, but you best set them aside. Wishing for what you can't never have only breaks your heart." Mama grabbed my hand and dragged me down the street toward the night house. A hot wind blew that August morning, not a whisper of rain on the gritty breeze. The Knights owned the biggest house in town, complete with curlicued latticework, fancy gables, and a wraparound porch. Mr. Knight, a canny businessman, made the most of the western migration of the times by running a string of Route 66 motels and car dealerships. Each spring my brothers painted the house spanking white. The Knight mansion defied swirling red dust storms and sparkled under the shade of sturdy elms and a bountiful pecan tree. It rose to castle dimensions in my imagination, complete with a princess, me of course, under the spell of an evil witch. The evil witch was portrayed by Aunt Peach Knight, who spent her days casting spells and torturing cats, or so I imagined. I'd never set eyes on her, and neither had anyone else of my acquaintance except Mama, and she didn't say nothing except Peach was an old white woman. Aunt Peach resided on the third floor, a mysterious figure whose presence brought no end of speculation for the town children and gossip mongers. That summer of 35, I took to shadowing Mama on her days to the Knight Castle. She cooked and cleaned, taking great pride in her work like she was some kind of captain of a mighty ship. Even Myrtle Knight, the missus of the house, let Mama have her fussy way. Some days that high-toned woman even helped Mama with the chores. As Mama and I came into the kitchen one particular day, the sight and smell of vine-ripened tomatoes overwhelmed my 8-year-old senses. Bushel baskets overflowed red. Ripening fruit blanketed the sturdy oak table. Baby greenies rested on the countertop, waiting for their turn in the frying pan. I wiped my dusty bare feet on the mat and gazed in wonder at the explosion of vegetable bounty. Myrtle and Mama cranked up the coffee, set the big pots of water to boiling, and donned fresh aprons. The great day of putting up tomatoes had begun. Chapter 2. Long about 11 o'clock, as the boiling and skinning was going full tilt, a clanging noise echoed down from the house from the upper reaches of what I imagined as the witch's lair. So far, I'd avoided following Mama up to Aunt Peach's tower, always making myself scarce whenever the bell clanged. I was wiping a canning lid as Mama said, "Oh, Lordy, she'll be wanting her buttermilk and cookies just when I'm elbow deep in hot tomatoes. Maisie, you take Miss Peach of victuals." Well, she might as well said, "Maisie, go fling yourself into Hades' lake, a perpetual fire." No way, no how did I want to trudge up those stairs. Oblivious to my terror, Mama quickly prepared a tray. Truly, I recognized the measure of trust Mama conferred on me to carry out such a responsibility. Yet I stood trembling like a rabbit hiding in a briar patch. Mama held out the tray. "Move along, girl." I shook my head, speechless with fright. Mama's face took on that fetch-me-a-switch look, and I knew disobedience would meet with swift and sure punishment to my backside. Well, caught between the certainty of a whipping and the fear of the unknown, I gripped the tray and turned toward the hallway staircase. Up and up each creaky step I rose, conjuring images of what horrible sights would meet my eyes at the top. My brothers took fiendish delight in scaring me with Aunt Peach stories on hot summer nights. She ate small children, finding skinny-colored girls especially to her taste. She rode a broomstick by light of the full moon, casting wart spells on the hapless townfolk below. My knees knocked, imagining Aunt Peach's monstrous face. I almost reached the final stair when the bell clanged once again. The buttermilk wobbled, but by some heavenly deliverance did not topple. My feet shuffled across the polished hardwood floor as I neared the open doorway. I tucked my chin toward my chest and focused on the glass and cookies on the tray, hoping to avoid seeing the horrors of bats and skeletons hanging from the ceiling. The clanging stopped as I edged inside. "Well, it's about time," croaked a reedy voice. "You may place my refreshment on this table." I stole a look across the room. The frail white woman sitting in a cane-back rocking chair didn't meet with my witchy expectations. Small of body and dressed in layers of lace and gauze, Aunt Peach resembled a fairy more than a witch, a very, very old fairy. Thin, pale skin stretched over fine cheekbones, enhanced by a touch of rouge. Fluffy white hair puffed up on her head like a cloud. Sky-blue eyes tracked my progress toward her. As I set the food on the doily-covered round table, her trembling fingers reached for a cookie. In that moment, I very much doubted her ability to ride a broom in the midnight sky, and, in fact, her hand shook so badly, trying to raise the glass of buttermilk, I dashed to her assistance and held the rim to her dainty lips. She sipped and waved it away. "Blast and double blast," she said. "These days I'm only fit for playing Methuselah. Will you bring my shawl from the footboard, please?" Courage to explore my surroundings grew as the witchy warnings dissolved like smoke. Aunt Peach inhabited a room more round than square, the top of my imagined castle, eight-sided with windows all around. Sheer curtains dipped in tea for color hung in swathes at each frame. The room smelled of lilac water and old books, for there were many of them scattered about. One bookcase could not contain them all. They covered two tables, lined the floor next to the bed, and lay stacked against the floorboards. An oak armoire and battered trunk held her clothes and belongings. I turned in a circle, enraptured by the walls. Instead of fussy landscapes or pictures torn from catalogues, tall posters covered every available space. Women with long, flowing hair embraced muscular men dressed in tight pants. A fine lady in a red gown lifted her hands wide open and gazed forward with great haunted blue eyes, eyes that reminded me of... I turned and stared at Aunt Peach. The poster lady's eyes winked back at me in the aged face. Her lips lifted in a half smile. They said of my Lady Macbeth, "Peach Knight fascinates and captivates with a powerful portrayal of ambition gone mad. Personally, I consider Portia my greatest role." My only point of reference for posters were those that hung outside the Luther movie house. I asked, "Was you in pictures, Miss Peach?" She scowled. "Picture shows! Mere shadows on a wall! I should say not!" Her voice grew stronger. "I was in the theatre, flesh and bone and voice and spirit, bringing the age-old classics to life. Picture shows, indeed." I found the shawl she requested and brought it back to her, gently tucking it around her narrow shoulders. Despite the summer heat, her tired bones took a chill. She gazed up at me with speculation. "What is your name, child?" "Maisie, ma'am. Maisie June MacDonald." Peach held out her hand. "A pleasure to make your acquaintance, Miss MacDonald." I stared at her hand offered in respect and refinement, as I'd seen folks do on Sunday mornings with the pastor. But never had anyone offered such a greeting to me, the forgotten last young'un of the sprawling MacDonald clan. Sweet warmth filled my belly like sorghum on fresh cornbread. I grasped Aunt Peach's hand. "Howdy, ma'am." Her head shook, and she whispered in instruction. "Pleased to meet you, ma'am." I repeated, "Pleased to meet you, ma'am." She smiled and set her chair to rocking. "Tell me, Maisie, have you ever heard of William Shakespeare, the Bard of Avon?" Chapter 3. Thus began the unlikely friendship between a fading star of the American theater and a poor black child of the Depression. From that day forward, I jumped at the chance to answer the clanging bell. Mama and Miss Myrtle welcomed a break from the trek upstairs to attend a useless old woman. But I never saw a useless relic. I gazed upon a storybook queen. As far apart as we seemed in age, experience, and social status, Peach and I shared a kinship of soul and spirit. Peach revealed a whole new world to me, full of mystery, fantasy, and adventure, all come to life through the magnificence of words. Words strung together in such wondrous ways from men named Shakespeare, Dickens, Thoreau, and Longfellow. Beyond that, women named Austen, Dickinson, Bronte, and Eliot set my imagination on fire. My rudimentary reading skills leaped forward that summer as I read aloud from the classics strewn about the magical tower. But the most spellbinding moments came from Peach herself, when she had the inspiration and energy to participate in the day's entertainment. She'd instruct me to turn to a certain page in a certain volume, and off we would go, back to the old Globe Theatre and her beloved Bard of Avon, reciting, "The quality of mercy is not strained." The years fell away from Peach's shoulders as the character Portia sprang to life. Her portrayals of Rosalind, Juliet, and Titania enthralled me. I absorbed her lessons like a sponge, and Peach regained some of her old vigor. Her hands quit shaking. One day she rose from the rocking chair, taking the floor as center stage for her rendition of Lady Macbeth. "Out, damned spot! Who would have thought the old king would have so much blood?" And Peach took to pacing the room with her cane, still frail, but burning with creative energy. Reading the plays no longer sufficed. Peach became star and director. I took on all the other roles in her favorite scenes, and though I stumbled and mispronounced, Peach sailed through our dialogue and praised my performances as if I were a regular Barrymore. One afternoon, in late fall, we sat sharing a luncheon of cold chicken, cornbread, and buttermilk. I wiped my sticky fingers on a cloth napkin and wandered to one of the windows to look down on the world that seemed so distant below. A hobo tapped at the kitchen door, a common sight in that year of jobless, hopeless, national despair. I turned toward Peach, preferring our make-believe world to the harsh realities below. Yet, knowing the joy Peach could give with a tilt of her chin, a twist of her wrist, and the lilt of her voice, it seemed a shame to have her all to myself. "Miss Peach," I said, "now that you're feeling better, do you ever think about going back to the theater?" Peach shook her downy head. "Gracious, no. I've made my exit from the stage of life. I'm just waiting for that great director in the sky to pull down the final curtain." Well, keeping such gifts of God held back from the greater good seemed a sacrilege of the highest degree, even to my undeveloped intellect. "Gosh, Miss Peach, if I could act like you and remember all them fancy words, I'd be putting on shows on the street corners just to raise folks' spirits." Peach lifted her twisted hands. "Oh, time is a cruel trickster. It replaces the splendor of youth with a grotesque transformation of wrinkles and crooked bones. The spirit within remains unchanged while the outward shell disintegrates. How should I be remembered? Like this?" She pointed to the powerful poster of Lady Macbeth. "Or like that?" She stood before the full-length mirror and regarded the reflection of an aged white woman draped in shawls and lace. "Besides, my self-imposed exile is a pleasant sanctuary, far cleaner and happier than the squalor below. I read the papers, I know of the food lines and riots. No, I shall never step foot from this house again." How could one old, feeble woman help a world of such overwhelming need? "Well, you've helped me, Miss Peach. I'm sure you could help others the same way." She appeared truly amazed. "I've helped you? In what way? Surely you must know you've been a wonderful gift to me, not the other way around. You listen to an old woman's meanderings and allow me to relive past glories. Why, Maisie, you're a treasure." I blinked in wonder. She thought me a treasure. Me, Maisie June MacDonald, generally regarded as a dawdling, no-account extra mouth to feed. "Well, thank you, Miss Peach. I think you're a treasure, too." Peach's eyes twinkled and lit on the trunk in the corner. You know, our theatricals have been missing an important element. Costumes. Open my trunk, Maisie. I'm in a Macbeth mood this morning. Glory, glory, talk about treasures. Peach's costume trunk revealed creations of velvet, satins, and lace. I came to know the mysteries of garters and stockings. And though the crimson Lady Macbeth dress was a mite crushed and hung on Peach's shrunken frame, she sent shivers up my spine, delivering her mad scene with added dramatic flair. Peach generously encouraged me to play dress-up, a little girl's delight. Being a sturdy, tall child, I took up much of the length of the clothes, though it would be several years before my womanly virtues would spring forth in their current splendor. I took a special fancy to the flowing, shimmering green costume of Titania, the Fairy Queen. Sporting butterfly wings, I flitted around the room in my galloping, gawky manner. "Float, my dear," Peach coached. Then she shook her head with mild dismay. "I fear running amuck in bare feet isn't doing much for your deportment. Try on a pair of my slippers and see if they help you get into character." Well, even as an 8-year-old child, my feet and hands foretold of the large frame woman to come. Try as I might, I couldn't cram into Peach's dainty footwear. I felt like one of Cinderella's ugly stepsisters failing to fit the glass slipper. I sighed and stood before the full-length mirror, aware of the scruffy brown toes beneath the magic floaty material. "I guess Mama's right," I said. "I ain't no Shirley Temple, even if I had them fancy green shoes from the shoe store." "What green shoes?" Peach asked. I flapped my arms before the image in the mirror to make the wings fly. "Oh, there's a sparkly pair of green shoes at the Mercantile. I see 'em every day as we pass by. Mama says I shouldn't dream about things I can't never have." Peach hobbled beside me to the mirror, Lady Macbeth and barefoot Titania side by side. "Maisie, dream stealers are the worst thieves in the world. Without dreams, our lives are nothing but daily drudgery, waiting for death to end our misery." Her face glowed with inspiration. "You shall have your green Shirley Temple shoes. How much are they?" I stuttered. "The sign says $4, but I ain't got 4 cents to my name." Peach clomped with her cane to the dressing table and extracted a fancy beaded purse holding more money than I'd ever seen in my life. $4, a mere pittance. I once spent $400 on a seed pearl evening gown. "Here," she said, waving the bills, "go purchase those shiny green shoes. They'll always remind you that dreams do come true." Empowered by the fire of Peach's impassioned speech, and still dressed as the Fairy Queen, I charged down the stairs, dreaming of those green shoes all the way. Time and experience had not yet taught me that dream stealers come in all shapes and sizes. Chapter 4. My feet pattered in the dirt-packed road, jumping rocks and the occasional road apple. A car chugged by as I rounded onto Main Street and leaped onto the sidewalk. My eye-catching costume stirred immediate attention, and I soon had a following of assorted children, 2 old geezers from the barber shop, and a few white women known for their gossiping talents. Feeling like the star of my personal play, I welcomed the attention until one of my brothers, Ozzie, showed up. "Maisie, where'd you get that get-up, girl? You supposed to be a caterpillar or something?" I continued walking toward the store, staring straight ahead. "I am Titania, the Fairy Queen." Ozzie grunted. "If Mama sees you strutting around town dressed in flimsy green curtains, you're going to get switched." My stardust courage wavered until I saw the green shoes in the window and felt the $4 burning in my hand. "Dreams come true," I said to myself, and marched through the Mercantile store door. Miss Flat, the broad-bottomed, wave-faced store owner, was putting up cans behind the counter. She turned around at the sound of murmurs and shuffles in her establishment. Her eyes widened behind thick glasses at the cluster of customers surrounding a black girl in what might have been odd pajamas. Under her bug-eyed glare, my resolve failed, and I stood struck dumb. "Well," she barked, "what do you want?" "I have come to buy the green Shirley Temple shoes," I said, and held out my $4. A collective gasp rippled through the onlookers, followed by whispers of speculation as to the origin of my fortune. Ozzy spoke out loud what everyone else must have been thinking. "I don't know where you stole that money, but Mama is going to whip you good." He dashed out the store. I gazed at the crowd. "I didn't steal nothing. I was give the $4 for the shoes." Miss Flat crossed her thick arms and growled at me like a grizzly bear. "And what kind of clothes are you wearing, you little thief? Get out of my store. I don't need you driving off my good customers." Something in me snapped when I realized Miss Flat was attempting to steal my dream. I elbowed aside the lurking crowd and made for the display window, reached in with my skinny arm, and snatched the shoes. Though it grieved me to slip gritty feet into the shiny shoes, I sensed it was now or never and forced them into the forbidden fruit, so to speak. Miss Flat waddled her girth through the crowd and bellowed when she saw my dusty leg above her pristine merchandise. She shook me by the shoulders and cursed. I tried to give her the $4, but she seemed uncontrollably affronted by my shopping methods. The crowd erupted with equal fervor, and I realized they considered me a thieving upstart, audacious in my selection and suspect in my resources. Tears rose in my throat as I sensed the ferocity of emotion against my simple desire for a pair of pretty shoes. A girl like me did not deserve, would never be worthy of such finery. The humbling moment nearly snatched a lifetime of dreams. Then the crowd parted like the Red Sea, and Aunt Peach Knight herself entered in full Lady Macbeth regalia. The mob turned into an audience, riveted by the sight of Luther's elusive leading lady, not that any of them knew of her former glory. "Maisie, I see the shoes are a perfect match. How wonderful!" She transferred the $4 from my hand into Miss Flat's fat fist. "Here you are, shopkeeper." She paused and surveyed the crowd, taking in their tattered clothes. Times were hard. Drab clothing matched the mood of America. In our colorful attire, Peach and I stood out like jaybirds amongst a flock of mud hens. Peach took my hand and led me through the gawking crowd, using her cane more like a prop than a walking aid. "Come along, Maisie, we have a lot of rehearsing to do." In the doorway, she turned around and addressed the crowd. "You're all invited to our upcoming holiday extravaganza. Back by popular demand, Peach Knight returns to the theater." Chapter 5. Peach and I sashayed our way to the Knight mansion, passing my slack-jawed mama and brother. I later learned Peach had overheard Ozzy relating my shopping excursion in the side yard as Mama labored over the wash-tubs. Peach realized she'd sent a lamb to the slaughter. Once we made our way back to the tower, Peach's show of strength dissolved, and she collapsed onto the rocking-chair. Though tired of body, her face glowed. "That was amusing. Peach Knight can still make an entrance." She rested her head back and commenced a gentle rocking. "You know, my dear, I believe I've had an epiphany. I've distanced myself from the outside world, living above the pain and poverty, thinking my usefulness at an end. But today I glimpsed those faces filled with crushing hopelessness, people without dreams, lost in despair. Perhaps, somehow, some way, I can lift their spirits, even in this old wreck of a body. Maybe that's why I'm still here." Thinking back now on that period of history, I realize 1935 bottomed out the worst of the Depression era. Living smack dab in Dust Bowl country, families were pushed to their limits that terrible year of raging walls of dirt, drought, and death. Folks tried to beat the choking dust back by sealing off doors and windows, but the suffocating stuff just blew through all the barriers. Black dirt clouds blocked out the sun as if Lucifer himself was riding the wind. Christmas of 1935 promised to be meager and downright mournful. Fractured families missed people gone west or departed altogether from this world. My two oldest brothers left after the great August storm, promising to send money to the family when they found work in California. Mama's hair turned entirely gray over the course of the summer. What if the rains never came? How long would wells keep pumping and food supplies last? What if no work could be found even for the most willing hands and the strongest backs? The future appeared bleak. Peach realized folks needed something to look forward to, something to dream and wonder about. She commenced planning the first holiday extravaganza for the citizens of Luther, Oklahoma. She descended from her tower and rejoined the human race. Of course, she initially met resistance, especially in the form of Miss Flat from the Mercantile, who refused to donate as much as one candy cane to an old actress who mostly kept company with a rude black girl. Undaunted by early discouragement and living by the oath the show must go on, Peach forged ahead. She convinced her nephew, Mr. Knight, of the excellent public relations by offering his automobile showroom for the event. Next, she worked her way through town dressed in an 1890s gown and charmed the mayor, newspaper editor, and ministers of both the Baptists and Presbyterians to support her cause. She held auditions, inviting anyone with hidden talents to be part of the extravaganza. The Luther Ladies Auxiliary climbed on board, taking over food preparations. The night kitchen became a hub of activity, and even my stoic mama volunteered to work on decorations. Final victory came the day Miss Flat knocked at the back door, offering 3 bolts of material for shepherd's costumes, and asking, could her daughter Bessie be Mother Mary for the inevitable manger scene? Peach pulled it all together, pushing her frail body to its limits, somehow finding untapped reserves of energy. On December 22, 1935, the town folk gathered at 6 p.m. at the Knight Automobile Emporium. Wearing threadbare gray coats and holy gloves, careworn families entered a world of color and magic. A potluck supper filled empty bellies with chicken pot pie, roasted potatoes, and apple fritters. Each child received a shiny California orange, courtesy of Knight Motors. The local piano teacher played Christmas carols in front of a leaning cedar cut from the fields. A sprinkling of tinsel and donated ornaments hid the tree's spindly branches. Clustered behind the makeshift curtain, the cast adjusted costumes and headpieces. Nervous actors whispered lines. At precisely 7 p.m., Peach Knight took the stage dressed in a green velvet gown rejuvenated with red piping, lending that holiday touch. Arms spread wide, Peach opened the show. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the holiday extravaganza of 1935. I trust you are all pleasantly full from the excellent repast provided by the Ladies' Auxiliary. A hand for the chefs, if you please. The audience cheered, and the aproned women at the food tables glowed at this public expression of appreciation. Peach continued. If all the world is a stage and all the people merely players, we are fortunate indeed to have a treasure trove of talent in this very town. It has been my honor to discover a wide range of performers for your pleasure and delight. And now, without further ado, please give a warm welcome to our first performers, the Goosen Family String Band. And so it began. A country variety show featuring washboards, banjos, and old-time barbershop harmony. High school girls recited poems, and the mayor's wife rendered an ear-splitting version of O Holy Night. My brother Ozzie, dressed like Mr. Bojangles, danced and brought the house down. Ozzie got his first sprinkling of stardust, smiling and waving at the audience as he took his bow. A lip-moving ventriloquist borrowed a Charlie McCarthy routine from the radio, and a trained hog with a big red bow around her neck squealed and performed piggy tricks to the delight of the backwoods crowd. Spectators hooted and guffawed. I peeked through the curtain, taking in the grinning faces. There hadn't been so much laughter in Luther since raccoons raided Miss Flat's cracker barrels. Worries ceased to exist for a few precious moments. Truly a Christmas miracle. After an accordion player finished caterwauling jingle bells, Peach quieted the audience and took center stage to begin the finale. While I'd expected her to choose a scene from her beloved William Shakespeare, she selected a soliloquy from a much older text. Her dramatic stance commanded absolute silence, charging the air with anticipation. Lifting one hand and speaking in a stage whisper, she began extolling the 91st Psalms. "He that dwelleth in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty. I will say of the Lord, He is my refuge and my fortress." She paced the stage, a performance fit for the crowned heads of Europe, not just the rubes of Route 66. She built emotion and glory into God's promise of spiritual security. "A thousand shall fall at thy side, and 10,000 at thy right hand, and it shall not come nigh thee." Emoting with Shakespearean style, she reminded the town folk of God's promises of powerful protection. Her arms rose majestically, each gesture precise and captivating. "He shall call upon me, and I will answer him. I will be with him in trouble. I will deliver and honor him. With long life will I satisfy him and show him my salvation." At the end of the verse, she sank into a deep curtsy. The hall hushed in hallow reverence of the Lord's promises. Well, following her stirring delivery, the curtain opened to reveal the nativity scene, Luther style, complete with a goat and two sheep. Mary and Joseph hovered beside a cradle placed in the hay, surrounded by assorted shepherds, trying not to scratch in their itchy costumes. Peach's voice rang out the Savior's birth, as told by St. Luke. "And there were in the same country shepherds abiding in the field, keeping watch over their flock by night. And the angel of the Lord appeared to them, and the glory of the Lord shone around them." I waited in the wings, trembling with excitement, listening for my cue. Of all the entrances that have come after, nothing compares with that first magical moment. The culmination of Peach's friendship, encouragement, and love swirled around me like a heavenly whirlwind. Could this be the same shy, awkward tag-along girl of last summer? That Maisie June would no more have made a spectacle of herself than jumped into the path of a roaring train. But now I gloried in my fancy costume, eager as a puppy for a bone to march out into that stage and say my lines. Finally, Peach cued the angel's entrance. Pushing the curtain aside, I raised my arms for full effect. A swath of sparkling material fluttered in the drafty hall. Taking a deep breath, I boldly proclaimed the happiest news of all time. "Fear not! Behold, I bring you good tidings of great joy, which shall be to all people. For unto you is born this day in the city of David a Savior, which is Christ the Lord." Maisie McDonald made her theater debut, dressed as a fairy angel with butterfly wings, wearing shiny green Shirley Temple shoes. Epilogue. A knock on the dressing room door startles me out of my reverie. "1 hour, Miss McDonald." Stirred into action, I sit at the makeup mirror and begin the transformation into tonight's character. If only Miss Peach could see me now. Of course, she'd give me some sharp pointers to improve my portrayals. A rhythmic rap announces my brother's arrival. Ozzie pops in. "The line is around the block, sister. New Orleans loves us," he says with his flashy smile. He's come a long way from that scruffy kid in Luther, Oklahoma. I dust my face with powder and talk to his reflection in my mirror. "Ozzie, do you ever think about the old days back home?" He plops onto my couch, a tall, dark vision of masculinity dressed to the nines. "Not if I can help it. Dirt poor, scrambling for a living? No, thank you very much. I'd much rather concentrate on tomorrow. I've still got a lot of songs to sing." I swivel around and lean toward him. "Yes, that's what I've been thinking about today. You've got dreams. I've got dreams. And do you know who taught us how to dream, Ozzie?"
"Nope, but I'll bet you're going to tell me."
"It was Miss Peach, Ozzie, Peach Knight." I wonder if Peach had any idea the impact she made on so many people. More than 20 years have come and gone since that Christmas of 35. She passed over the following spring, leaving behind a few stage posters, faded costumes, and musty books. But her real legacy lay in the hearts and minds of the people she touched with her extraordinary talent. She infused hope and humor into a town down on its luck, and she taught one dark-skinned girl the priceless value of dreams. Gazing around the dressing room, I muse, we wouldn't be here today if it weren't for Peach. Even though she's long gone, I can still hear her sometimes. Maisie, don't let anyone ever steal your dreams. Ozzie grins, and you haven't. If somebody had told me our little Maisie June would run her own theater company and travel all over the U.S. performing everything from Porgy and Bess to Taming of the Shrew, I'd have laughed myself silly. But you've done it, girl, and nobody is laughing. I smile and pat his hand. You haven't done so bad yourself. I see all those stage doors, Jennies, waiting for you every night. You're quite the leading man. You better go get into costume, and don't you upstage me tonight. He kisses my cheek. I wouldn't dream of it, Lady Macbeth. Ozzie departs with the traditional theatrical farewell. Break a leg, little sister. Break a leg, big brother. I hear the audience murmur as I put the finishing touches on my costume. My burgundy velvet dress honors the memory of Peach Knight. Each performance is my personal homage to that fine trooper of the American theater. 5 minutes, Miss MacDonald, says the voice in the hall. As always, the last thing I do before going on stage is open my vanity dresser drawer and pull out my good luck charms. I rub the familiar patent leather and remember, dreams do come true. And I have the shiny green shoes to prove it. The end.